Just a heads up, this episode includes descriptions of violence. Welcome to the Urban Legends Hotline, where we investigate the mysterious tales of your hometowns and stories passed through the old lockered halls of your schools to get to the haunted heart of the urban legends that you grew up hearing and maybe even telling. This week, we are covering gang initiations, and this is Part 2. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and from one friend of a friend to another, this is American Hysteria. In late 1992 and early 1993, tales of a gang initiation rite known as Lights Out panicked Americans as faxes and emails were sent in towns and cities all across the country with concerning messages like this one. Police departments across the nation are being warned that this is the blood initiation weekend. Their intent is to have all the new bloods nationwide drive around on Saturday and Sunday nights with their headlights off. In order to be accepted into the gang, they have to shoot and kill all individuals in the first auto that does a courtesy flash to warn them that their lights are off. Send this to everyone you know and you might save a life.
You've got mail.
At the end of part one, we talked about the months leading up to this scare, about the Rodney King riots, Bill Clinton's self-serving publicization of Sister Souljah's comments that black gang members should kill white people instead of their own, and the untimely death of California school employee Kelly Freed in a shooting that closely mimicked the Lights Out tale, while actually having nothing at all to do with gangs, let alone some kind of initiation. We covered several of these made-up gang rituals, and amazingly, just as Lights Out made its big debut, each one was brought back to life in a tangled chaos of messy rumors crisscrossing the entire nation, with the newspaper mentions of gang initiations doubling in 1992 and then doubling again in 1993, just as the first Democrat entered the White House in 12 years, with a lot of help from a new alarmist law and order agenda.
Federal agents say the gangs are ruthless and show no remorse about shooting down innocent people who happen to get in their way.
In Oklahoma, flyers went around warning that gang members were, yet again, castrating unsupervised boys in the bathrooms of various big box stores, and that seven of these despicable crimes had already been committed. The rumors of gang members hiding under cars at malls and department stores, waiting to slash the Achilles tendon of women and pull them under the vehicle, returned again most prominently to the Tacoma Mall in Washington State, where my own mother had worked during the first ankle slasher panic of 1989 and worked nearby during the 90s wave, visiting that mall often, along with her darling child, me. We were not ankle slashed, obviously, but we certainly did hear the rumors, and as horror fans, we certainly believed that they could be true. These tales became even more powerful when media accounts of shopping mall parking lot rapists returned to Durham, North Carolina. Police went on record claiming that they had identified five black men who had abducted several white women from shopping centers to sexually assault them as part of an initiation. But the police also said that they didn't know much else about these crimes. Why? Because no one had actually stepped forward as a victim. They were simply going on the calls they had received from people who had heard the rumors. Nonetheless, the headline of News and Record in Greensboro, North Carolina read,
Durham police say rape, part of gang initiation.
Police Captain Eddie Sarvis told reporters,
We have identified at least 5 members of the gang today. Some are adults and some are juveniles. But unless someone's willing to step forward and positively identify them as a rapist and testify in court, there isn't much we can do.
When none of these rumors panned out, Sergeant Eddie backtracked.
We found nothing to conclude there is an active gang in the area.
Defending himself and his department, he continued.
We did not want to create racial tension in the community. Our intentions were absolutely noble. We had no intention of causing upheaval. We just wanted women to be cautious.
Just like me, lots of other American kids were hearing these rumors too, very much including the Lights Out version. An 11-year-old named John from Glencrest Middle School had his intense little opinion piece published in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram on December 5th, 1993. Where will it end? I think gangs should be stopped. I also think all gang members need to be put in jail. They need to have gangs against evil and violence. Gang members shoot and kill for nothing. If this keeps up, there won't be any people left on the earth. For example, in gang initiations, some members ride around with their car lights off and shoot people that flash their lights at them. Eventually, everybody will be carrying a gun just to be safe. Around the same time, in Tempe, Arizona, children from kindergarten to fifth grade were sent to the auditorium to view a play in which a young gang wannabe struggles morally with his initiation rite to stab a pregnant woman. A senior police officer who gave himself the hip-hop moniker Police Ice started going to elementary schools with his positive message about avoiding gang life, dedicated to someone who had apparently died in an initiation ceremony. Yes.
The street gang hype is nothing but a big joke. You gotta walk the line to get off in one. To prove yourself, they stomp your butt and front you on a friendship. That's just what they do to have fun. The drive-by shooting is a gangbang thing to let the blazing gunfire thunder. It's just a coward's bum rush on a gang move tip to put a homeboy 6 feet under. What really makes it tragic is a bullet has no conscience, and when it flies, it surely will break through. To add more flowers to the caskets of families in the homes, your mom, your dad, or baby sister too. Oh,
yeah, the message today to the Bloods, the Crips, to every criminal gang preying on the innocent is clear. We mean to put you out of business, to break the backs of your organization, to stop you from terrorizing our neighborhoods and our children, to put you away for a very long time. We have just begun the job, and we do not intend to stop until we have finished.
In October of 1997, as anti-gang rhetoric continued to be a big part of political discourse, our urban legend combined forces with the annual panics around what we in the folklore industry call the Halloween sadist. You know, the candy poisoner out to get random trick-or-treaters just for the pure evil of it. According to a story circulating through the New York school system, a different kind of Halloween sadist, or rather a network of Halloween sadists, were causing quite the stir among parents, educators, and police. rumors of prospective Bloods planning to murder young children as an All Hallows Eve initiation rite were printed in news articles and spread through the airwaves by the shock jockeys of talk radio. Although it is common for students to skip classes on Halloween, there was a marked increase in absences across the city. According to news reports, hundreds of thousands of students stayed home from school, with several campuses in the district seeing more than 80% of their students absent. In one school in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, that number was 90%. A high school for especially gifted students canceled their after-school activities and postponed a Halloween dance that was supposed to be held in their lobby. One of the two private schools in the area canceled all after-school activities, and the other canceled classes altogether. High-ranking officers of the NYPD stated that these reports were unsubstantiated, but this only brought the story to far more people and lent it legitimacy because the police were actually making public statements. Compounding that feeling was the fact that at many of these schools, police spent Halloween morning escorting children to their classrooms and spent their afternoons patrolling outside the schools, their heavy presence making it look like there was definitely something really big to be afraid of. Of course, the day after Halloween, both police and school security guards announced that there had been no violent incidents whatsoever, let alone a mass murderous gang initiation.
They are the legends we've all heard.
Gang members drive around at night with their headlights off, and when someone goes to flash on their high beams to warn them, they kill them.
The stories we've all told.
I want to know what's going on here.
Someone out there is taking all these urban legends and making them reality.
Urban legend.
Have you heard the one about the microwave?
By the next Halloween season, in September of 1998, the teen horror movie Urban Legend, one of my personal favorites, premiered in theaters. And the very next month, the lights out tale began to spread once again. Funnily enough, it was this very urban legend that provided the film with its big reveal that a couple of suburban white teenage girls had heard the tale and decided to act it out in real life to mess with a random person, leading to the accidental death of a young man through what is referred to in folklore studies as pseudo-ostension, where people already aware of an urban legend acted out in real life, creating more fake proof that the original legend is true. But this pseudo-ostension happened in a fictional movie about the falsehood of urban legends, so it seemed especially silly that at least 34 states had newspaper articles documenting the Lights Out hoax that was popping up in their towns and cities. But such is the life of a salacious crime legend. It's almost unstoppable. A few years later, in September of 2002, in Passaic County, New Jersey, a gang initiation rumor quickly traveled through its cluster of towns when three seventh-grade girls told their parents that they had heard that local gangs were planning a day of bloodshed, a ritual shooting of a mother and child as they made their way to that very evening's back-to-school night. The parents called the principal, who immediately called the assistant superintendent, who immediately called local law enforcement. As the rumor continued to spread, block by block, email by email, and now in 2002, text by text, dozens, if not hundreds, of citizens frantically reported the rumors to the authorities, who made their own frantic calls to stations in West Paterson, Totowa, and Fairlawn to see if they were hearing similar stories. As the cops tried to suss out what was really going on, it took mere hours for these sinister stalkers of a helpless mother and child to transform from a nameless gang into who else but the Bloods. Then the rumor took on another dimension. A woman had actually already been murdered near Eastside High School. Then it grew larger. 4 people had been murdered. No, 12 people. No, 22 people. Then it turned into 30. That Thursday, 35% of the district's 25,000 students stayed home from school. Police flooded the district's campuses, both in uniform and undercover, waiting for the chaos and gore that the rumors had promised, which, of course, never materialized. In reality, just a few hours after those first frightened parents of the 3 girls got in contact with the school, one called back. While eavesdropping on her daughter, she heard her talking to her friends, admitting that they had made the whole story up. It turned out that they had concocted a little plan to use this urban legend to their benefit, to keep their parents away from that evening's back-to-school night. They went hard, but I think we can be generous to these kids and assume that they did not mean to cause the snowballing panic that followed what they imagined would be a great excuse to get out of something they didn't want to do. I mean, who among us, right? The next day, the head of the police gang unit in Passaic County, Detective Andrew Muckle, told newspapers,
"I think there was very little validity to it whatsoever. All of the people we deal with on the street said this is just not the way things happen."
Talking about the massive response to the revived urban legend, he said,
"Never in my 20 years as a police officer have I ever seen something like this. The whole city came to a stop."
Nick?
Hey, honey. I love you, and we'll be home soon.
Hey, where do you think you're going?
I need something to drink, Dad.
Okay, well, quick in and out, because we gotta get home.
You can do this.
In late August of 2007, an action movie called Death Sentence by horror director James Wan came out in theaters. The film stars Kevin Bacon as Nick Hume, a happy family man who witnesses his son's murder in a gang initiation rite and vows bloody revenge at all costs. Movie critic Roger Ebert concluded his review of Death Sentence this way, quote,
"Basically, this is a movie about a lot of people shooting at each other."
The DVD would hit Blockbusters and Hollywood Videos and department store electronics sections in January of 2008. It's one of those movies that kind of gets forgotten, but according to the newspapers that quaintly used to list what was going to be on television that week, this movie played on various channels all the time, for years after its release, no doubt worming its way into the minds of those who came across the sensational story and gratuitous violence. More after this. You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week, and you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code AmericanHysteria50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And now, back to the show.
In the 2 years Barack Obama has been campaigning for the White House, he has seldom emphasized his African-American identity. But he knows it's an issue.
Will there be some folks who probably don't vote for me because I'm black? Of course.
But this AP Yahoo poll out today suggests it's more than some folks feeling that way, and they could make the difference in Obama's run for the White House. The poll, conducted with Stanford University, found 40% of white Americans hold at least partly negative views about blacks. 20%, for example, said the word violent strongly applied to black people. 22% agreed with...
Over the next 2 years, just as America was meeting and then electing the first black president of the United States, a nationwide gang initiation panic, second only to 1993's, would see the same legends we covered pop up again and again, along with some brand new versions as well. In January 2008, several emails made the rounds across the country stating that gangs were initiating new members by asking innocent people for directions, often in mall parking lots, and then shooting them to death. Then in March, an email calling out the Salvadoran gang MS-13 for their initiations went viral, with one example ending like this. Let all know that there is a Mexican gang initiation going on now. If someone bumps your car, do not get out. They will shoot you. This is what I got in a text message in Memphis. This is true. In October of 2008, as Halloween approached, so too did a spooky version of the gang initiation rumor. Please use extreme caution tonight. To my understanding, a local gang in Rocky Mountain, the Crypt, is out to kill 31 women by midnight tonight. A lady that attends my church who works at Golden East Crossing and Mall Security is warning all women to please be careful. Please pass this on to everyone you know. Then came the familiar story of department store gang murders, this time centered around Walmarts, with news articles reporting on the scare in at least 44 states. A few months later, the winner of Most Extreme Version of the Story traveled not only through email and text, but also across social media. National Gang Week is starting. If you see a baby car seat sitting on the side of the road, do not stop. These are gangs targeting people, especially women, to stop their vehicle to help a baby. They make this baby look as if it has blood on itself or on its clothes. When you get out of your vehicle in an attempt to help, the gangs jump out from cornfields or tall bushes. They have beaten women to near death and then continue other torture methods. This is not just a forward of information. It is within our area. If you do happen to see a car seat, do not stop. Call the police immediately. Please send this to everyone you know. After the 2008 and 2009 spike in gang initiation legends, they never seem to return with the same gumption that they once had. But they do continue to circulate to this very day, including in 2022, when there was a panic on the campus of Western Michigan University. The rumor being that gang wannabes were going to kill students on Halloween. In 2023, a TikTok post went viral telling the Lights Out legend to thousands of users.
Posts online saying if you flash your headlights at an oncoming car driving with their lights off, you could become a victim of a deadly gang initiation.
It's a warning that people have shared online and in email chains for decades. But is this a real thing?
Though the initiation angle has fallen out of style, general panics over gangs do continue, like in Halloween of 2023, when illegal immigrant Mexican gang members were apparently handing out fentanyl-laced candy to trick-or-treaters, an urban legend promoted by certain media outlets as truth and proof of this vicious threat trickling into the suburbs. To be clear, we know that drive-by shootings occur. We know there are drug-related murders. We know that there are, in fact, gang initiations. But research has long shown that the vast, vast majority of these rituals involve initiates proving their toughness with what are called jump-ins, where they're beaten up by the gang for a number of minutes. Sometimes it's true, though far more rare, that gangs may tell a prospective member to rob a random person or steal a random person's car. And in extremely rare cases, a crime like this has gone wrong, and violence or murder against a random person has occurred, but almost never in the intentional and organized way these urban legends describe. When you think about it, these urban legends start to fall apart at even the most basic questioning. Like, why would gang members want to commit crimes that would draw the most possible attention to their gang when they are generally trying to avoid the eyes of police? But at the same time, there is indeed at least one example of what appears to be a real gang initiation murder using innocent strangers. In August of 1998, 17-year-old Christina Walters and a group of wannabe Crips in Fayetteville, North Carolina, abducted three women unknown to them over the course of one night, stealing their cars, placing them in the trunk, robbing them, and eventually shooting them in cold blood, with two dying at the scene and one surviving to tell her story. Though the details of this night are messy, seeming at times to be closer to three robberies gone wrong than some kind of official ritual, police and prosecutors have maintained that they believe these killings to be part of an intentional initiation rite. And here's why. They said that the group used bullets that were tipped with blue nail polish, and traces of that nail polish were found in the wounds of the victim and in Christina Walters' trailer. I could find no other mentions anywhere in newspapers or online about Crips using blue-tipped bullets for initiations or crimes, but there isn't good enough evidence to debunk this particular instance. But regardless, long before this seemingly real-life example of the kind of legends that we've been telling, the rumors of gang initiations were already playing their part in massive changes to the criminal justice system.
The LA police have spent millions of dollars in the campaign, putting more officers on the street, putting their specialized crash unit, community resources against street hoodlums, to work on a new system of developing intelligence, creating a new computer program.
I think it's fair to say that the sweeping laws imposed through the 80s and 90s to combat the gang problem were influenced by stories of psychopathic members who were willing to kill, rape, and maim innocent strangers for what amounts to a sinister game. As these decades led to the U.S. claiming the highest rate of imprisonment in the world, politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, made bold claims about the threat of these savage young criminals, some eventually referring to them as super predators, violent inner-city youth who would bring about an almost apocalyptic crime wave that simply never materialized. States all across the country began creating specific gang task forces within their police departments, and these officers started creating gang databases, official lists of gang members in their jurisdictions, as well as anyone they thought could possibly be associated with a gang. Any crimes that appeared gang-related could land a person in the database, but so could colors of clothing, tattoos, who they were seen hanging out with, what family they belonged to, where they hung out, where they lived, and what they drew on the margins of their notebooks at school. And since the list was based entirely on the unsupervised opinion of cops, pretty much anything could be considered suspicious. Being in the database meant the police were allowed to detain suspected members at their own discretion without the kind of evidence they would need to detain someone not in the database. Higher bail was automatically set for those on the list compared to those who were not, even if they committed an identical crime. By 2003, after more than two decades of gang panic, a shocking 47% of Black men aged 21 to 24 living in LA County were listed in the gang database versus 0.5% of white men in the same age group.
And new tonight, the LAPD is placing a moratorium on entries into and the use of the Cal Gang System. That's a database designed to identify and track gang members. The LAPD has been accused of misusing the system. And tonight, the department said the accuracy of the database has been called into question.
In 2018, it was revealed that 99% of the thousands of people in the New York City gang database were Black or Latino, despite law enforcement's longstanding claim that 11 to 15% of gang members are white. However, other surveys conducted by agencies independent of government authority sources estimate that number to be closer to 40%. In either case, it's clear that white alleged gang members are very underrepresented, with skinhead and motorcycle gangs almost never included. An audit of California's gang database in 2016 showed unconscionable and confusing reporting errors, with 42 infants included on the list, more than half of whom were listed as members who had admitted their membership in a gang. In most cases, there is no clear-cut way to get removed from these databases, not for those who were wrongly accused or those who were at one time members of a gang but have since cut ties with the group. The racial bias present in the New York and LA databases is not a standalone issue. Cities across the country show similar statistics. In California in 1987, politicians and law enforcement created the Street Terrorism Enforcement and Prevention Act, known as STEP, which was the beginning of what was called gang enhancement sentencing. These laws, mimicked in other cities across the country, made it so that those identified by authorities as gang members could face much harsher sentencing. The additional prison time added onto the sentence could be anywhere from 3 to 4 years for nonviolent felonies, 10 years for more serious felonies, and anywhere from 15 years to life for certain violent crimes, but also for home invasion robberies and carjackings. This means that the enhancement could actually be longer than the sentence for the actual crime committed. Throughout the 1990s, civil injunctions also became a major part of the war against gangs. They allowed courts in the United States to keep gang members in their cities from doing things that were otherwise perfectly legal. These injunctions could be slapped on entire gangs themselves, a broad category that could be used against anyone a police officer believed to be part of a criminal organization. And they were often placed on entire housing projects or entire neighborhoods. Those who were served injunctions could be barred from things as simple as wearing certain kinds of clothing, making certain hand gestures, standing in groups numbering two or more, and standing in a public area for more than 5 minutes. They could actually be arrested and charged with crimes under these injunctions. And since it was technically a civil order and not a criminal one, they were not entitled to use a public defender. In most of the stories that we've told over these two episodes, those assumed to be gang members were under the age of 18. In the 90s, Democrats and Republicans crossed the aisle and worked together to allow more and more minors to be tried as adults, to build more juvenile prison cells, to eliminate parole for youth offenders convicted of felonies, some just 14 years old. In addition to prosecutors being allowed to decide to try minors as adults, 45 states changed their juvenile life without parole laws. The United States is actually one of only a handful of countries in the entire world that allow children to be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, an international treaty that forbids this practice, has been ratified by every UN country but the US, with 132 countries forbidding the practice entirely. In 2005, there were 13 countries that allowed juvenile life without parole sentences, but only 12 youths in the entire world were sentenced this way, while in the U.S., that number was 2,225. According to the Human Rights Watch, between 1985 and 2001, minors convicted of murder were more likely to be sentenced to life in prison than adults convicted of the same crime. Unsurprisingly, Black minors were sentenced to life without parole at rates estimated to be 10 times greater than their white counterparts. In California, where the gang laws were some of the harshest and most widely used, that number was greater than 22 times. In Pennsylvania, Latino minors were 10 times more likely to receive life without parole than white minors convicted of the same crimes. Of course, there are many gang members of all races that commit horrible acts, and there's no reason to paint these groups in broad strokes of a victim narrative. But having some kind of gang association by no means renders one a violent criminal, and those who join gangs are most often born into communities that lack funding for education, lack job training and job prospects, as well as affordable housing. Neither gang injunctions nor gang databases nor harsher sentences for gang-related crimes for minors have proved to be effective tools of fighting gang crime. In fact, these laws further harm neighborhoods by locking up parents and leaving children to fend for themselves, and by arresting children who are put into the system before they turn 18, and when they're released, face even greater hardships, feeding them back into gangs that exist as one of the only alternatives. What has been effective in curbing gang violence is the choice to use public funds to create gang prevention programs that include improving public schools, funding after-school programs, providing further educational opportunities, providing job training, and increasing job prospects, as well as providing affordable housing. Luckily, these gang databases and gang enhancement sentences have come under the microscope in recent years, and major changes have accompanied this, though these laws are still in action in different jurisdictions across America, despite the fact that statistics show that this type of crime has been on the decline for decades. But meaningfully addressing the underlying causes of gang violence is still far from a priority, and questions remain about exactly what was going on behind the scenes of these anti-gang laws and why.
The California Department of Justice says it's now blocking the LAPD's use of its statewide gang database after some LAPD officers were caught submitting falsified data about innocent people. Now, three officers have been charged, and more than a dozen other officers could face charges.
This follows the filing of conspiracy, false police report, and fabricated evidence charges against three LAPD officers last week, and a new audit that shows lots of other data in the gang system is unreliable.
Now, yesterday we reported that another 16 LAPD officers may still face criminal charges. That's in addition to the three charged last week, all of them suspected of turning in interview reports that falsely labeled people as gang members when they were not, or
more after this.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And now, back to the show. In an article in the Commercial Appeal out of Memphis, Tennessee, in March of 1997, titled
"Memphis Police Jolt Lawmakers with Report on Gang Initiations,"
four officers from the Memphis Police Department's gang unit participated in a bipartisan hearing with lawmakers in which they presented a series of apparent methods of violent gang rituals that involved the harming and killing of innocent civilians. Sergeant Richard Parker claimed that cars of gang members drove around with their headlights off, following home and shooting to death whatever good Samaritan flashed them a gentle reminder. Quote,
"It was considered easy to kill a rival gang member, but it would show heart to kill an innocent bystander."
He continued,
"It's no longer an inner city problem. It's in the suburbs."
Democratic Representative Henry Brooks responded during the hearings, quote,
"The community is ready to get behind this. People are afraid to come out of their houses and go to church on Sunday evenings because of gangs."
This is very important because these hearings were in support of new legislation in favor of gang enhancement sentencing. In the midst of hysteria, folklorists have been one of the groups to push back against sensational falsehoods that have material consequences, like one John M. Shaw, who wrote a response in the Commercial Appeal newspaper following these hearings, pointing to several versions of this urban legend that had circulated for years. Quote, "It is disconcerting to me that local law enforcement, which is supposed to preserve the public peace, would promote mass hysteria and fear of Black youth by repeating stories of gang initiation methods of doubtful validity." Then he goes on to talk about the different faxes that had circulated for years about bogus gang initiations, saying that the police speeches at the hearing, quote, "seem a not so subtle attempt to inflame already volatile race relations in our nation." When we look at the clear racial coding in these legends, sometimes explicit, almost always implied, it makes sense to me that the main location of these alleged initiations are malls and department stores, public bathrooms, parking lots, and roadways, areas shared by all kinds of people, melting pots of culture where classes, races, and ages mix. It is often at these points of tension between strangers of different cultures that crime legends flourish. These pieces of contemporary folklore take the violence that can and does happen within gang cultures and the communities where gangs operate and refer that pain to those who have nothing at all to do with gangs. And the victims suddenly look more like affluent white people, suburban moms and their children, always implied to be innocent bystanders in a world gone mad. If the victims look like this and the perpetrators look like that, if the stories are sensationalized enough, law and order policy will be more successful for Republicans and Democrats alike and will carry those seeking political or financial power to new heights, as we've seen time and time again. These gang initiation stories remind me of the accusations of ritual sacrifices and frightening crimes against innocent women and children that have, for centuries, been leveled against major religions and identity groups by those of opposing beliefs, something still very much a tactic we see today. We create or believe this kind of propaganda when we are engaged in a war, both abroad and at home, a war on terror, a war on crime, a war on drugs, a war on juvenile delinquents, a war on gangs. All of it requires a kind of sweeping dehumanization, making any human being, even loosely associated with our so-called enemies, into irredeemable monsters, into collateral damage. When we demonize entire groups of people for the violent actions of a few or for cinematic stories of violence that are entirely false, we make excuses for sweeping punishments that can ravage communities who already lack institutional power. At worst, our urban legends express a subconscious fear of cultural others, and though police do work to publicly debunk these untrue stories, it is the police, the greater political system, and the media at large that have conditioned us to believe that these legends could be true in the first place. Think of Little John, that seventh grader writing to the paper in 1993, convinced that the Lights Out urban legend was true, convinced that gang members were coming to kill everyone on the earth. And like the sweeping anti-gang legislation has shown, we don't know how to differentiate between a threat and someone who looks like a threat. And it's obvious that those who benefit most from our fear don't want us to. Contemporary folklore expert and one of my biggest influences, Joel Best, was one of the main academics responsible for compiling and analyzing these gang initiation rumors back in the 1990s. In his 1999 book, Random Violence, he explained American culture's vision of these street gangs as they apply to a greater national narrative. Quote, ours is a society characterized by bureaucratic institutions. When we envision evil, it has an almost bureaucratic face. We describe modern gangs in these terms. Gangs are secretive. They are large and spreading. Their business is calculated, deliberate, and structured. Dealing in drugs, violence, and other crime, they form great, powerful hierarchies through super gang alliances, and their members have a rich, secretive culture of colors, gang signs, and initiation rites. The Street Terrorism Enforcement and Prevention Act that was passed in LA in 1988 defined a gang as, quote, an ongoing organization, association, or group with three or more persons, whether formal or informal, having as one of its primary activities the commission of one or more crimes, having a common name or common identifying sign or symbol, and whose members individually or collectively engage in or have engaged in a pattern of criminal gang activity. It sounds like this definition could stretch far beyond the Bloods and the Crips and could encompass many of our American bureaucracies. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but perhaps we imagine evil to have a bureaucratic face because it does. Locking those who decide to become part of the political gang into a system that forces them to lose their empathy until they are numb to the harm that they cause. Several of our urban legends today are cautionary tales, stories that warn us not to commit acts of service toward the community. Don't flash your headlights to remind a fellow driver to turn theirs on. Don't help anyone with directions. And do not try to save a baby from the side of the road, lest your good deed be punished with an unimaginable vengeance by those nameless and faceless hordes of sociopathic boogeymen. In these stories, there is a gang conspiracy against us. There are forces out there ready to harm us for nothing more than an advance in status. In our greater American story, for many, perhaps for most, this is true. But the gang looks very different from the ones in our urban legend today. So, if we flash an invitation to those that need it, we might together be able to illuminate our darkest highways. Maybe instead of being killed, we survive. Maybe we see who, all along, has really been behind the wheel, white-knuckled and lost to a terrible game. Unable or unwilling now to finally turn on the light. This was American Hysteria. We encourage you to do what you can to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and an end to the tremendous harm being committed against innocent civilians. You can find different ways to help in the link tree in our show notes. We'd love it if you'd leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline. You can tell us a tale you remember from growing up, and we might do an entire episode on the story you tell us. Just go to AmericanHysteria.com. If you want to get more of our show, you can head to Patreon.com/AmericanHysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus, and you'll get access not only to ad-free episodes, but also to our other podcast, Hysteria Home Companion, where producer Miranda and I share stories that didn't make it into the episode or stories that we think you would like. So if you want to support our show, you can head to patreon.com/AmericanHysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. American Hysteria is written, produced, and hosted by me, Chelsea Weber-Smith. Our sound designer and associate producer is Riley Swedelius Smith. Our producer is Miranda Zickler. And our voice actor is Will Rogers. Thanks, as always, for listening. And remember that we are strongest when we reject the stories that we have been told, when we figure out that they just don't make sense. I hope you have a great week.